want the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. If you were ordered to waterboard a terrorism suspect, would you do it? If you were ordered to cook the books at the company where you work, would you do that? And if a Texas state trooper ordered you to get out of your car when you're driving while black, would you do that? These are some of the questions I chew over today with author Ira Chalif. His powerful new book is called Intelligent Disobedience, subtitled Doing Right When What You're Told to Do is Wrong. And I think you'll find this a fascinating conversation. I certainly enjoyed it. And I think his book, which is not an academic tome, is a very accessible look at critical issues about groupthink, about being given an order that you know is immoral or unlawful. Better safe than sorry. This is for real. This ain't no game or folly. It's your life and you only got one. So you better do it right or it will soon be done. Thank you, young MC. The song is called Just Say No. And before we get to our conversation with Ira Chalif, I want to thank the people who said yes when I asked them to subscribe to this podcast and support my work. People like Brian Massey, who just renewed his annual subscription. Thanks, Brian. Kevin Beckley and Keith Hull are monthly subscribers. And we've got a Nixon supporting us, too. Pauline Nixon kicks in $10 a month, and I'm very grateful for each of these individuals. I invite you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the sign-up link right under my picture. Next page, you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month. You can make a one-time contribution using PayPal. The mailing address is there if you don't like PayPal and you want to send a check. It's all easy for you. And our best deal is the $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers get the bonus gift, the ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's latest called Empire of Chaos. Here's a big question. When is it appropriate to defy an order or a rule? Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Ira Chalif is founder and president of Executive Coaching and Consulting Associates. And he's published two very interesting books. I've only read one of them, but I assume the other one is very interesting, too. It's called Courageous Follower, Standing Up to and For Our Leaders. His new book, which I'm holding in my right hand, is Intelligent Disobedience, Doing Right When What You're Told to Do is Wrong. And as a lifelong rule bender, I was really engaged with this book. I read every page. And I want to recommend it to my listeners because I think it raises a lot of important questions about groupthink, about going along with consensus, and also just about your own standards and when you stand up for them. Ira Chalif, thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure, Peter.
As I mentioned before we started recording, your book really connected me in a lot of interesting ways, and I want to delve into many of them. But first, it might help our listeners to understand your concepts. First, of courageous followership. Explain what that means, because I've always resisted being a member of a pack and losing my personal control and identity.
Well, it's a good point. Human beings, we are social animals. It's difficult to avoid being part of some pack or other. The question is, how do we behave in that pack? I think it'll help you if I just give you a half a minute background. I was reading an analysis of the My Lai massacre 20-some years ago, and the author made an observation saying something seems to happen when we put ourselves in the follower role where we displace our moral accountability onto the leader. And that just sent light bulbs off for me, and I wrote in the margins, it sounds like a book on a new way of following is needed. And that's what The Courageous Follower became. It basically says, when you're not the positional leader, how do you help the leader use his or her power beneficially, and how do you correct them if they start to misuse their power? So that's what courageous followership means. Now, the next light bulb 20 years later that went off was when I was teaching a class on courageous followership, and we were talking about the subject of authority, how most of the time it makes sense to implement what you're being asked to by authority, but sometimes it doesn't, and sometimes it's dangerous to do so. And a woman in the class said that she had an example of that under the table. And I said, what do you mean under the table? And she said, I have a dog under the table, and I am training it how to obey all the commands it will need to know for when it becomes a guide dog for a blind person. Mm-hmm. But then it needs to go to a higher level trainer to teach it intelligent disobedience. I never heard that term before, and I said, well, what's that? And she said, well, it's when the dog gets a command that if it obeyed would create harm for the human and the dog or for the team, it must know not to obey, how not to obey, and how to resist obeying, even if the command is repeated. And at that point, I went, wow, if we can train dogs to discern between those two states, why aren't we doing that better with humans? And that's what intelligent disobedience is about.
And Ira, I just have to tell you these two quick connections. I'm a dog lover, and my dog Chloe pipes up during the interviews from time to time, so don't be offended if you hear from her. But also, the neighborhood where my office and secret studio are located is a favorite place where Guide Dogs for the Blind trains guide dogs. And so when I take Chloe out for our midday walk, we often encounter these working dogs, and I have observed what you talk about, where they'll come up to the corner ready to cross a street, and the human will give a command, but it is up to the dog when to implement that command based on the conditions that she or he can observe there. And so a lot of this, you know, your metaphor or the model of training guide dogs is something that really made a lot of sense to me.
Oh, that's terrific. I went to the oldest guide dog training school in the U.S., which is on the East Coast, to observe how they do it. And clearly, it's very similar. I think each school might have some variation. In addition to knowing how not to obey, it also needs to know a few other things, such as, I love what they call it, a counter-pull. For example, if the person is going to take a step forward and they will fall off a platform or steps, the dog has to pull them in the other direction. I love that image in terms of what do we need to do when our leaders are about to take a step in the wrong direction.
And Ira, your book is replete with many examples. I'd like to inject one of my own because it occurred to me as I was reading your book, as you were talking about the mid-level accountant at WorldCom, who agreed to cook the books and then, of course, regretted it and went to jail along with Bernie Ebbers. And this certainly doesn't rise to that level. But in the 1980s, I was working as a disc jockey in San Francisco, hosted a morning show on a station owned by the CBS network. And CBS is a very lawyered company. That's the best way I can put it. You can't do anything without contacting the legal department. And whether it was, you know, just minor issues on a contest or a bumper sticker, we always had to call the law department. Well, one day my boss told me that he had a way of jacking up the ratings by lying about what time it is. And I won't go into too much detail, but the game in the ratings, the way it used to be conducted, was that if you got people to listen from, say, 6:10 to 6:20, you would get credit for two quarter hours. You'd get 30 minutes of recorded listening, even if you only got them to listen for 10 minutes. And so if the song was short and I was going to take a break at 6:19, I was instructed to say it was 6:20. And I had a real problem with this because I just, you know, I don't like to lie. And listeners have ready ways to look at their own clock and say, wow, what's wrong with him? He's giving the wrong time. And so I came up with ways to satisfy my boss without lying to my listeners. So I would say, it's about 6:20. It's coming up on 6:20. It's pretty near to 6:20. But I refuse to flat out lie to my listeners, even though it's a pretty minor issue. And I just wanted to toss that out there and let you chew on it a little bit, because it's the kind of thing that people confront almost on a daily basis, where they're asked to cut a corner or, as you say, come off the curb.
Well, you've actually hit on a very, very important dynamic in our culture, which is a very metric-oriented culture. Everything's measured, and then there are significant rewards and penalties that get attached to the metrics. And that is one of the most common ways in which pressure is exerted down the line for people, implicitly or explicitly, for people to fudge, to do the wrong thing. And it's something that we really do need to learn how to manage. I think you did pretty well there, as a matter of fact. I mean, there were no lives at stake, et cetera. It was not something you needed to take a definitive moral stand on, but neither did you want to become complicit in it. So you found a way with language to not do so. And I think that's instructive.
Mm-hmm. And you raise some much more life-threatening situations. The submarine is about to surface, and there's a routine drill of turning the periscope, twice 360 degrees to scan the horizon. And the order is given to raise the submarine to bring it to the surface. And a very low level, not even an officer, requests permission to look at the periscope. And then seeing a ship heading directly toward this submarine as it is surfacing, he calls out an order that a captain would normally call out for essentially an emergency response to throw the submarine into reverse and begin an emergency dive.
Yes, again, you're picking very good examples from the book to illustrate larger points. In that specific example, there was a protocol where there's life and death situations. It makes a lot of sense, doesn't it, to train people in advance what are the options to take in a situation where you have seconds. You can't have a conversation about this. And so clearly the training on no longer making the hierarchy the dominant value, and instead making the safety and the lives of everyone aboard the dominant value, kicked in, and everybody aboard complied with this. As you say, that he wasn't even an officer, directive. And that's a beautiful example of how we need to be able to shift in situations like that. And we do see that starting to happen more in different segments where people are getting trained in this. So, for example, in hospital surgery rooms. It used to be that nobody questioned the surgeon. And, of course, as we know now, we had far too many medically caused errors. And nowadays, virtually all hospital surgery rooms have a protocol where before you begin a surgery, everyone in that room has to verbally give their assent to starting the procedure. In other words, they say, yes, it's, we have the right patient, we have the right limb, we have the right replacement part, etc. Mm-hmm. And similarly, before they end, before the surgeon can end the surgery, everyone has to agree. And if the lowest person in that room says, I counted 13 sponges in, we only took 12 out, I can't agree, the surgeon has to stop and look. This is moving in the right direction. We're not doing it in enough areas of our culture, but taking these exemplary instances, I think, is very, very useful.
And Ira, the submarine anecdote, again, sung to me. I'm a sailor, and I skipper a sailboat on San Francisco Bay. And I'm a genial guy. I don't like to yell at people or bark out orders. But I will often say when I bring new crew members on board, I remind them of a little brass plaque that my dad had, which was attached to the rear seat of one of our boats. And it said, the captain's word is law. And I explained to people that you're free to ask questions, you're free to move around the boat, but there are certain times when I'm going to give you an order, like move to the starboard side of the boat. And I ask you not to hesitate or to challenge that, because I'm looking at the big picture here. I'm about to bring the boat about, and I don't want you to get hit in the head with the boom. And so I said, you're welcome to talk about it afterward, and you're also welcome to tell me if there is a boat or some other obstruction that I don't see. But if I give an order, please take it, you know, and execute it properly and immediately, because I only give orders for your safety.
Well, that's a very interesting example for a somewhat different reason. I've also been at sea, and I know how important it is to do instantaneously what you're told to do under most circumstances. Now, having said that, let's move for a moment to the aviation industry. Although these days this applies to the Merchant Marine and the Navy as well. They call it bridge resource management. At sea, they call it crew resource management in the aviation industry. There are rare times when the captain gives an order that, if implemented, would be disastrous. And what they do now in the aviation industry, as well as the shipping industry, is drill people. And there's two requirements. One, everybody is responsible for situational awareness. It's not a matter of that you see a danger and you think, well, you know, if it was really a danger, the captain would have seen it. No, if you see it, you have to call it to the captain's attention. And secondly, you have to call it to the captain's attention assertively enough so the captain gives it his attention and makes a decision. Now then, once he makes a decision, again, we're back to, you know, where you introduce this topic, you have to comply quickly. But the important thing is to no one in that crew can safely relinquish their accountability. Now, you're in a certain sense using a slightly different situation here, because they're probably a little bit more like passengers than your crew.
Yeah,
I'm suspecting. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, that is part of the followership, the intelligent disobedience, is knowing 99% of the time obey, but that one time when you know obeying will cause harm, you need to know how to not obey and instead alert command to the risk.
Now let me take us to a real world situation that is top of mind here as we're speaking at the end of July. Sandra Bland was stopped by a Texas state trooper in Waller County, and it was because she changed a lane without using her turn signal. And many people have seen the video of this interaction with the state trooper, where I believe he seriously overreacted. He got into a kind of power trip. But Sandra Bland was standing her ground. She knew her rights. And in particular, when the trooper ordered her to get out of her car, she smelled a setup. She knows what has happened to other African Americans who were given a similar order by a law officer in a situation like this. And she flatly told him, I don't have to get out of the car. I am not under arrest. And so she was trying to use what I think was very intelligent disobedience to the aggressive and escalating efforts of this cop. Tell me your thoughts as you look at her behavior in that critical situation.
Well, this is a very difficult situation. As the book was going to press, we were seeing firsthand through these videos, Ferguson, Staten Island, Baltimore, we were seeing all of these situations in which a person of color would do something minor, the police would overreact, and it resulted in tragedy. And I felt that I needed to be responsible on the subject of intelligent disobedience. I needed to put a cautionary note both in the front of the book and at the end of the book, saying that if you are a minority in a majority-dominant culture, you need to be very, very mindful of how and when you disobey. You may be absolutely right legally, but the moment may be, it may not be intelligent to disobey at that moment if it's going to trigger a life-threatening event. This is what African-American parents certainly tell their sons all the time. You know, you keep your hands visible, you say, yes, sir. It's painful to have to even say that in a democratic society, but it's reality. So my cautionary note in those situations is to obey, and as soon as you are in a safe situation again, then get the community support, the media support, the legal support, and call to attention the misuse of power.
Mm-hmm. And in the narrow specifics that I cited here of Officer Ancenia insisting that she come out of the car, she was well within her rights to refuse that order. And I do understand your cautionary note, and I'm not disputing it in any way. And it is tragic that she is now dead, and the circumstances are still largely unexplained. But I have to say, as I watched that video, Ira, I'm hard-pressed to say that I wouldn't try to do the same thing. I know what my rights are. I have talked back to police officers who have stopped me. Not quite I've never called them an MF or a pussy. and clearly, as she got aggravated and was injured by this officer, she lost some of her control, and I don't countenance that. But in my central example here, where he told her to get out of the car, she was not under arrest, and she declined, I think she was exercising a form of intelligent disobedience.
You know, I don't know the state law, so I can't say for sure what her right was or wasn't. I'm going to assume that what you're saying is correct. I still, situationally, again, this pains me to have to say it, because my whole thrust is to not obey unjust authority or ill-advised authority. But I feel that human life and safety has to be the first value. And I just can't encourage people to stand on their rights when they have, you know, they know that we have a racially charged dynamics. We have police who, for whatever reason, their training isn't training them to de-escalate the situation. They're overreacting. They are armed, and it's, I just can't say that it's truly intelligent at that moment to disobey.
I understand. So, Ira, one of the first I want to mention that Phil Zimbardo wrote the foreword to your book. He is back in the news again. Since he conducted the Stanford Prison Experiment back in the 1970s, there are kind of waves of interest in it. Now there's a film that is out about the Stanford Prison Experiment. And you go into some detail about how people operate in situations where they are given instructions to do something that escalates to the point that it is clearly outside of their moral comfort zone. And the Stanford Prison Experiment was really one of the first well-known efforts to look at the psychology of these situations.
Well, I'm very fortunate and grateful that Dr. Zimbardo found the book worthy of writing the foreword and giving it such a strong endorsement. He was one of a cohort, really, of experimenters in the 60s and 70s who were examining the social forces that seemed to dominate individual behavior despite one's personal disposition, value system, etc. In the book, one of the things that I do is really, in a sense, revive some of this research, but I've always felt that the research, as it has come down to us, focused on the sensational parts, which is how people acted in abusively or obeyed when they shouldn't. Yet the intention of these was to understand better how to reduce that inappropriate obedience. And there was a lot of good research done in the 60s and 70s that we've lost sight of. And one of the things I'm doing in this book is, with it's not academic, scholarly, it's not heavy. I'm reviving these examples and bringing them into our current world. So, for example, how did what happened at Abu Ghraib relate to what Phil Zimbardo tried to show us 40 years earlier? These are really important questions. We view ourselves better than we actually often are in those difficult situations. All of us like to think, well, I would never do that. But the experimental data shows that many of us, under the right circumstances, would. And so now, 40, 50 years later, we're still bemoaning the fact that people behave this way. What I'm trying to do, I'm setting a new goal here, and Phil Zimbardo is supportive of it, that I would like to see us change that behavior. I would like to see us do some fairly simple things, as we do with guide dog training, to inculcate people and youth from a pretty early age in how to differentiate when to obey, when not to obey, and to give a little bit of practice, a little bit of tools, if you will, to create that distinction. And I think that's what's going to make a difference when nothing else really has 40 or 50 years later.
Well, Ira, I want to go a little deeper on the example you cited about Abu Ghraib. And before I do that, I just want to note, and I'm not sure that you would be aware of this, but you actually made a little news in the anecdote that you relate in your book about the soldier who was at Abu Ghraib. And when ordered to waterboard somebody, he wiggled out of that by saying, well, put that order in writing. And that's a very powerful episode. What I'm referring to is that our government maintains that only a handful of CIA detainees were waterboarded, and I don't believe that. And you just provided a little bit of verification of my suspicion on that count. But I want to look at the bigger picture here, because Abu Ghraib, the CIA black sites, the propaganda film Zero Dark Thirty, these expose the underbelly of American policies in the last 12 to 15 years. And we know that hundreds, if not thousands, of people participated under order in what were called enhanced interrogations that often crossed the line into torture. And we have the Senator Feinstein's CIA torture review that was published last December. We have the flap that is currently still a controversy at the American Psychological Association about the participation under orders of psychologists in actual torture sessions. And so I'd like to ask you, because I think we have a systemic problem where illegal and unconstitutional orders have been given and widely followed by members of our military and our intelligence community.
So this is where it gets really important in terms of systemic. And I'm going to address what you're talking about now. I'd also like to address much more deeply what is it in our acculturation of our youth that creates the background willingness to comply with authority when you're being asked to do something that you know is not right.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to bring in Milgrom once again.
Let me set that up, because we didn't actually mention Milgrom yet. Milgrom was the Yale professor who conducted a series of experiments that are now essentially banned because of the depth that they went to. But he set up these situations where the actual victim of his scheme was seen as being given the power to deliver electric shocks to a subject who answered a question incorrectly. And before the person who had control of the shocks was essentially an array of buttons that were clearly marked about the level of voltage that would be jolted into this person if they selected a specific lever. Why don't you pick it up from there?
Yes, thank you. So we know about that. You know, virtually everyone who's done a Psych 101 class knows about that. Why hasn't it changed? Well, again, I think we've lost sight of what Milgrom discovered and what I'm trying to bring out in this book. So, for example, these CIA analysts that went along with the pressure to violate their own codes and the, you know, international treaties, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't there, but I can virtually guarantee you that not everyone immediately said, okay, great, I'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
So Milgrom identified four stages. And he said the first stage was cooperation. You're trying, whatever you're being asked to do has a plausibly worthy end. Okay, we're trying to prevent more terrorist attacks. Everyone agrees with that. Okay, how can I help? But then when you see how it's being done, he says the next stage is called, he calls it the strain phase. We start to get uncomfortable, and you start to say things like, are we sure this is okay? You sure this won't kill anybody? It's a very weak level of protest. Now, unfortunately, and this is the critical point, what happens is people then let themselves off the hook. So I can just see some of these psychologists later on saying, well, I tried to tell them, you know, that maybe this wasn't right. Not good enough. It's what you do, not what you say, okay? So then the next phase,
mm-hmm,
he calls the divergence phase.
Right.
And in which you either now are going to, if this is becoming clear that this violates core values, you're going to have to be really clear saying, this is not in accordance with what I'm willing to do. And at that point, you're going to get pressure back, just like the officer in the story I told in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to be told, you know, Peter, you just do what I said. And then at that point, to resolve this this tremendous stress you're feeling, you have to, one of two choices. You can either comply, which resolves the stress. You're now, you know, you're not fighting with the authority. Or you can amplify it and say, I will not do that. And that's where we need to train people better. The military code is crystal clear. No one is obligated to obey an illegal order. In fact, they must not obey illegal order. Why do they do it anyway? It's these social pressures. And a little bit of training in this direction can change that.
And Ira, as we look at this, Milgram's experiments in a broad sense produced about an 80% cooperation rate where people would accept the order to deliver even the highest voltage. And these voltages were fake, by the way. I don't want our listeners to be misled about that. But that's how this was depicted to the people who were observing it. And when we look at our intelligence community, and let me just limit it to the CIA for this example, we only have one individual, John Kiriakou, who kind of inadvertently became a whistleblower on the CIA's torture program. They have almost 100% loyalty in a program that clearly crossed the line and on regular occasions. And we know that some of these torture sessions were directly monitored and controlled from the Situation Room at the White House, where members of the National Security Council were there. They were interested in what the individual might cough up, but they were actually micromanaging these torture sessions. And so the individuals who were carrying them out believed that the orders must have been legal and appropriate because, of course, they came from the highest command.
Again, Milgram sheds a lot of light on that for us. The people who kept administering shocks, even when they thought they could be fatal, why were they doing it? There was no gun held to their head. There was no great monetary reward. They were doing it for two reasons. One, they thought that there was a socially beneficial ultimate aim here. In that case, it was to learn how we can improve the rate of learning. And secondly, the authority figure, all that made him authority figure, was a gray smock and a lab coat and a clipboard, said the experiment had to continue. That was enough for two-thirds of the subjects to continue. So we know here that we have, there are certain social constructs that are going to put people in a position where they talk themselves out of their own values and go along. What we need to do is start at an earlier age. It's too late. We're dealing with a symptom here, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go way back to the indoctrination children get in school. They spend, 14 years of their lives where they, you will sit in the seat, you will walk in the hall holding hands, you will sharpen your pencil, this, whatever it is.
15,000 hours.
And this meta program gets installed on obedience to authority. Now, we know that children need to learn to understand authority and obey when it's appropriate. But what are we doing to help balance that with equipping them to question and resist and push back when the authority is wrong or unethical? That's where this guide dog metaphor is so useful. And what I want to see is parent groups, reading groups, starting to talk about this and examine how within the home, within the family, within the school system, how can we create more preparation for those fairly rare times, but critical times when people need to know to obey and disobey.
Ira, one thing that is now becoming more clear is that the cadre of drone pilots, these are trained individuals in the Air Force, for example, at Creech Air Force Base near Las Vegas, and they sit in a room there and monitor big screens and control both the navigation and the observation gear and the weapons that we have on these advanced unmanned aerial vehicles. And the number of people willing to do this is declining sharply. They're having trouble filling these positions because of the kind of fatigue, a kind of PTSD that we've never encountered before. And I won't trouble you with my politics here, but I've studied the drone issues very closely, and it's clear to me that we kill many civilians. We have killed some so-called high-value targets. There's no doubt about that. But many innocent people have been killed by our drone efforts, and who knows this better than those who are actually controlling them? And so we also see a huge spike in suicides by members of the military, starting with the deployments in Iraq in 2003. And so I'm curious about your view of the true impact of people who follow orders that they clearly, or not clearly, but they are likely to become uncomfortable with, and it leads them not to want to do that work anymore, and it may leave them scarred for life.
Well, you're raising interesting data. I think it's healthy that when people say, no, I won't do this any longer. Of course, if we really step back, Peter, just think about the American pilots who dropped incendiary bombs on Dresden and killed 80,000 people in one night. You know, war is this terrible, you know, it's just horrible in terms of killing innocent people. So, you know, in a certain sense, we can be thankful that we're creating a little bit less of that. Nevertheless, it's a very real situation. Again, one of the things that worries me, and I'm not saying I have answers to this, but that Milgram found that if people are remote from the consequences of their action, they're more likely to obey. And that's a problem in a world of drone warfare because, you know, in The Courageous Follower, for example, I start the book off with an example, a dedication, actually, to a soldier who was given an order to fire on a target. And he refused to fire because he believed that the people at that site were our own troops. And he was brought before a hearing, and the hearing officers, instead of disciplining him for disobedience, they found he was right, and by refusing to obey, he saved their lives, and they awarded him a medal. Okay, now but he could see those people. What happens when the target is 5,000 miles away? We really don't understand this. It's very problematic, very worrisome, and we need to, you know, really be asking some very serious questions about how can we nevertheless create a sense of moral accountability for acting, for complying, regardless of that we're insulated from the ultimate consequence.
Mm-hmm. And Ira, your book covers a range of these very, important situations where life and death are in the offing. There, you also talk about some non-critical situations. And as we wrap up here, I wonder if you can help my listeners understand how to scale their responses. For example, you offer one example about people who work in places where they keep track of job safety, maybe in construction. And they'll put up a sign that says, 103 days accident free. And this, tends to become, it has its own momentum where, okay, so then a minor safety violation occurs. Do you want to acknowledge that by, putting up the zero days since our last safety infraction? Or do you just kind of go along and smooth it over because it's not that big a deal? You know, you put a Band-Aid on it. It wasn't any serious incident. But this, becomes a slippery slope. And so when is the right time to stand and be firm? You drew a line, related to Sandra Bland. But in the workplace, how much do you go along to get along? And when do you stand your ground and say, I'm sorry, I can't accept that instruction. I will not carry out this order.
Generally speaking, the sooner you take your stand, the better. Because as you start complying, you start to become complicit. And then you have to rationalize your own behavior. So the sooner you can take a stand, the better. If you can frame that stand so that the authority figure understands why, it's also in, ultimately in their interest to rethink and withdraw the order, you have a better chance. So, for example, yes, it's unfortunate that we will break our record of no accident days, mm-hmm. but which would look worse? That it, you know, let's say it's a, you know, a Toyota or, you know, one of these car companies where you're getting these safety glitches that are creating serious accidents and deaths. Mm-hmm. The sooner you take a stance and say, you know, it's ultimately better for your not just for the people who are affected, but for the organization, for your brand, for your legal stance, the better. And interestingly enough, oftentimes the people in formal authority will get it and they'll rethink. Now, they won't always. I'm not being Pollyannish here. But until someone takes that stand, you don't know. So that's the message here, is that they were each responsible for being accountable for whether we obey or don't obey.
Ira, it's a pleasure talking with you, and as you can tell, I really got a lot out of your book. I highly recommend it to my listeners. It's called Intelligent Disobedience, and it's out in soft cover from Barrett Kohler Publishers. And I hope you'll write another book about some of these broader political issues that I've raised, because I think this is a serious problem in our culture. And I actually think it's getting worse, Ira.
Well, maybe we'll have to collaborate on that one, Peter.
Okay, I'd look forward to that. A pleasure meeting you. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this interesting, in-depth interview with Ira Chalif. Send me your comments, peter@peterbcollins.com. That's an order.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.